This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The bombshell drug dealing indictments and secret texts in the Catherine Kealoha case and the petition by the state attorney general to suspend Keith Kaneshiro as prosecutor because of a conflict of interest are the latest developments in a public corruption case by federal prosecutors. We invited Loretta Sheehan, the chair of the Honolulu Police Commission, to sit down with us this morning. She served as deputy city prosecutor under Charles Marsland and Keith Kaneshiro. She also served as an assistant U.S. district attorney and now serves in private practice.
There is a serious need to restore public trust. On the other hand, if you follow the news and the subject and target letters and indictments that are coming down, there's actually reason to have a great deal of trust in our government, because as painful as these episodes have been, they reflect that the system is working and that our Department of Justice is, in fact, investigating, and that grand juries are asking the right questions and seeking the right evidence and making sure that corruption is found and acted upon. So actually, while yeah, the headlines are distressing, if you step back and think about it, it means that the system's working, is that these grand juries are finding probable cause to believe that these people did these crimes. And these cases will then go to a jury trial where a jury will have to decide whether there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and they'll either acquit or they'll convict. And that's the way the system's supposed to work. You know, and that's why we have a state system and we have a federal system, and the federal system can look into what the state's doing. So in a way, people should be a little bit buoyed by what's happening, that alleged corruption is not going unchecked, you know, and that it is, someone is doing something about it. And so that's actually cause to be happy.
So while there may be attempts to obstruct justice, that the system of checks and balances is there for a reason, and that the truth will come out, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem from the headlines that the feds are doing a very careful investigation and going jot by jot by jot. The fact that they would go and get documents or text messages or email messages of Catherine Kealoha saying, "I will love and protect you always. Go team. Can't wait for this S to be over. Then we're free." I mean, that shows really careful investigation. That shows that they're, and that's probably why it's taking so long, is that they are going jot by jot by jot. It sounds like they're doing the investigation right.
And for the folks who haven't read the paper, the article is about the latest charges against the prosecutor and her brother, drug charges, which I think a lot of folks are really surprised about, that this was going on for as long as it was, if it's found to be true.
Well, a grand jury found that it's probably true. There's probable cause there, and so they got indicted.
How are you looking at these target letters?
Yeah, I read Attorney General Connor's petition, and it's quite straightforward. The Attorney General is the top law enforcement officer in the state of Hawaii, and every single county prosecutor operates through her authority. So her petition says, look, I have standing. I have the ability as the top law enforcement officer in the state to bring a petition to point out when a prosecuting attorney is acting in an apparent conflict of interest. And you, Supreme Court, as the supervisor of every single person who has a law license in this town, you have supervisory authority to ask someone or to command someone to step aside, to step down, to take a break, and to suspend that person from a specific job. So this is an extraordinary writ. It's never been done before. I think clearly Attorney General Connors has the ability to ask. I'm hoping that the Supreme Court takes action on it. I'm hoping they have a hearing on it. They clearly have the power. They clearly have the authority. They could punt, and they could send it over to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, which operates under their supervision as well. The problem with that is that typically ODC hearings take months and months and months and months and months. They take forever. And so I thought Attorney General Connor's petition laid out the urgency. Stuff has to happen now. In his position as the prosecutor, Mr. Kaneshiro controls who gets prosecuted, the crimes they get prosecuted for, what plea deals are cut, what kind of sentences are going to be sought, whether someone's going to get probation or get 20 years. I mean, he has an enormous amount of power. And the problem is that the position he's in, he's under federal investigation. There are people out there, for example, Tiffany Masunaga, who could arguably testify against him. And he has a say in what sentence she's going to get on the state side. So that's a clear conflict of interest. You can't have authority over someone who basically has leverage over you. You know, you're tainted. And that's why he should have stepped down. He's in a clear conflict of interest. So given that he refuses to step down, the Supreme Court has to take action, I think.
And you mentioned Tiffany Matsunaga, and I believe is one of a number of co-conspirators in the Ke Aloha case. It was a little distressing to read in the paper this morning that as part of the plea deal, there's a line in there that says that you won't share information with federal investigators. What did you think of that?
I thought that was flat-out obstruction of justice. I thought, what in the world? I mean, that you won't share information? That's what law enforcement is supposed to do. We are supposed to share information with our brothers and sisters in other agencies, including the Department of Justice. I'm not sure why obstruction of justice didn't get charged for that, but maybe it will in the future. That to me is unbelievable that was and whoever signed off on that plea deal, they have some answering to do.
Right, whether it's Keith.
Yeah, or somebody else in that office. That's insane.
So, gosh, what happens now? We've got a situation with you sitting on the police commission, and there was a settlement with the police chief that is supposed to get paid back if he gets convicted of anything. You voted against that settlement.
Yeah, I did. I thought it was a really bad idea. Well, my guess is we'll never, ever see that money ever again. You know, frankly, for a bunch of reasons. You could declare bankruptcy, we'll never see it again. It's very easy to make a case last 6 years. I thought it was the worst deal I'd ever seen. But, you know, people voted for it, so be it. So what happens next is we move forward. And that's the brilliant thing about Honolulu and about Hawaii is that people here are resilient and essentially good and honest, and we're going to move forward as a community. I think we have a great police chief here in Honolulu. I think we've got a whole new commission. I think that Keith eventually will step down or be forced out. That's my guess. These cases will proceed to trial. These people will either be acquitted because the jury could not find proof beyond a reasonable doubt, or they'll be convicted, and the system will move forward. What's important for us now is to all remember that this can happen. It can happen here. It can happen with people we like. It can happen with our friends, and that a government is only as good as the people who are in it. And as voters, we have to require accountability. We have to ask questions. We have to stay involved. I mean, one of the things I'm curious about, for example, with you brought up the $250,000 payment to Chief Ke Aloha. Now, people in the city council voted for that. And people in the city council knew that there wasn't any public hearing, which was very unusual. Why did they do that? Who was involved in that? Like, I have a lot of questions about what's going on at the city council and why they would allow for this essentially secret deal to go through. Why that was okay with them. I think that the Civil Beat Justice Law Center is doing terrific work in trying to keep government open. They've certainly done a lot for us to teach us about the Sunshine Law and the Open Government Records Law. For example, with Chief Ballard's evaluation, we're structuring a little bit differently this year where we're actually going to follow the law and take votes on what, if anything, should be open to the public and what, if anything, we are going to keep secret. And we're going to take votes that are required under the law that, to my understanding, have never been taken before.
So it's like lessons learned.
Yeah.
But, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking.
Yeah.
But stepping back, so you think that then there should have been some legal mind that would have said, not so fast?
Well, that might have been Donna Leong. I don't know.
Or even for the council. But there, I think there are lawyers on the council.
Yeah, who apparently didn't have problems with the way things were going. So, but again, I'm engaging in speculation because I was shut out of that process. I don't know what happened there. But my understanding is that when you're voting through a payment like that, there's supposed to be a public hearing, and there wasn't. It was just kind of all ushered through really quickly. And nobody even knew where the money was coming from. We saw Acting Chief Kerry Okimoto say, well, I don't want it coming out of HPD's budget. Do we know where it came from? No. And there's an amazing lack of accountability here. And the mayor's hands off, and I can understand why he'd want to be, but nobody seems to be anxious to tell the public what's going on.
I guess it's just amazing to me because when you look back in the wake and you see all the people that have just suffered in so many different ways, and maybe at the time nobody really knew the extent of the probe and what it would lead to. But certainly, just from where it started with a mailbox, is just stunning.
Yeah. Well, and actually, I tease him about it, but the person who really lit the powder keg was Ali Silbert. He's an assistant federal public defender, and he got the mailbox case. And he just thought it was a Menini case, and his guy was telling him, I didn't do it. I've been framed. They were surveilling me, you know. And Ali is a good lawyer, and he did an investigation, and he came up with some pretty terrific evidence. And when Chief Kealoha caused the mistrial in that jury trial, to his credit, Ali went to the FBI, and he's like, look, he rolled the dice. He took a gamble, and he revealed his defense, and he said, look, there's something really wrong here, and let me explain it to you. And, you know, first the FBI was kind of, giving him a jaundiced eye, and then they gathered up all of his evidence, and they said, yeah, we'll get back to you. And then we had the mailbox case. We had the indictments there. And it's, you know, it's colloquially known as the mailbox case, but it's actually much more serious than that. It's not this cute mailbox thing. It's actually people trying to frame another human being. It's the abuse of police power to frame somebody, which is a nightmare in law enforcement. It should never, ever happen. It's the worst thing you can do as a police officer. It's the worst thing you can do as a prosecutor. And that's what's alleged. So we call it the mailbox case, and everybody sort of makes fun of it. But no, it's about a person getting framed. And if it can happen to Gerard Puana, it can happen to you. So that's the seriousness of it. And then from there, it's sort of spiraled into an investigation of the Kealoha's finances and allegations of bank fraud and mail fraud. And then this, drug charges. You know, it's just astounding how it just keeps spiraling and spiraling and spiraling. And part of it, I mean, this is just from what I see on the TV news and in the newspapers, is this really antiquated idea that you're my friend, I got your back, I can, you know, if you ask me for a favor, like lying to the grand jury, I'll do it. Let me tell you something. That's a really bad idea to lie to the grand jury. That's a really, really bad idea. But sometimes there's a colloquialism here where you just, or provincialism, I guess I should say, where it's like it's all okay because you're my friend. And I think we have to recognize that those days are over. You know,
it's not okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for sitting down with us.
No, my pleasure. Yeah. My pleasure.
That was Loretta Sheehan, the chairwoman of the Honolulu Police Department's Police Commission, talking about the growing scandal involving the city's top civil lawyers and criminal prosecutors, as well as police officers and our former police chief, Louis Kealoha. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, na umawi o kahoolawe o Hawaii.
As we mark another Valentine's Day today, we're hoping to tug on the heartstrings of all you diehard Conversation fans. If you've followed us from the very beginning, back in 2011, you'll know that our very first broadcast aired on February 14th of that year. The show has gone through many transformations, three theme songs, three hosts, and a slew of production assistants, but all with one focus in mind: to serve you, the listener, with fresh local news with an intimate and sensitive approach. Now, we don't want to toot our own horn, but we've done a lot through the years, and since it's Valentine's Day and our anniversary, we wanted to say mahalo for sticking with us and thanks for all the love. So here's our head scratcher for today. Back in the day, we used to air newscasts that came from international bureaus all over the world. Can you name all five? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha. I'm Elizabeth Wickman-Walczak from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The judiciary's mission is to provide justice. But according to Chief Justice Mark Reckenwald, one thing that can get in the way of doing that is the lack of judges. The issues where it's becoming acute is in areas that affect the family and cases involving impaired driving. We talked to Senior Judge Robert Mark Browning about why the judiciary feels it can't wait any longer for relief for an additional district judge to help with the ballooning drunk driving caseloads.
We need another judge because the number of judges that we have now simply is not enough for us to be able to address the numerous cases that are being filed. And the difference between what was in 1995, for example, in terms of numbers, and this is based upon the data that we've gone back and looked at till now, is very dramatic. I mean, it's important to note that we haven't had an additional judge added to the bench, to the district court bench, since 1982, rather. So that's 36 plus years. And since 1982, looking at the population here on Oahu, there's been an increase, at least till from 1982 to 2016, of 230,000 cases. So since 1995, looking at DUI cases, 1995 we had 2,179 cases, and in 2018 it's more than doubled. It's 4,622 cases. So that's a dramatic increase, and given the kinds of limitations that we have with respect to all the duties that district court judges are required to basically to attend to in terms of all the other cases and the jurisdictional issues that we have to deal with, we obviously are have issues with respect to getting these cases done in a timely way, and that's what we want to address. We're not only asking for another judge in district court, but we're asking for another judge in family court and on Maui, for another district court judge and another family court judge in Kauai. If you're asking me, could we use another judge in district court other than the one that we're requesting, the answer is obviously yes, given the number of cases that we have. We also are very indebted to the legislature, and we know that there are multiple problems and issues that they're having to deal with respect to issues in the community that restricts the amount of funding so that they can give us. So we're looking to at least address the DUI issue by being able to to take a judge position, in addition with two clerk positions that always comes with a judge position and a bailiff position that will allow us to be more flexible and to hear these cases in a more timely way.
Right. The caseload is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And then just to make sure that everybody's got due process and their case is heard in a timely manner.
Exactly. Due process is core to our constitutional rights, and it is about basic fairness and the understanding and the commitment that we have to trying to be able to, well, not trying to being able to live up to that core value is something that we take very, very, very seriously, and is something we try to honor each and every day that we serve.
What about the need for judges on the neighbor islands?
Maui has seen an incredible increase in their population. And the Second Circuit, for example, not only serves Maui, but it serves Molokai and Lanai as well. The Maui County population, from what I can tell based upon the information I have in front of me right now, has doubled since 1982. So our caseload over there has increased by 30%. So we really need another judge over there as well. We haven't asked for another judge in district court till this session. We've asked for another judge in family court for a number of years, and we haven't gotten that. The fact that we have not been able to fill the position in family court for the last 7 or 8 years that we've been asking has been an issue for us because of the kinds of cases that family court sees that are basically cases and involve issues that are central to who we are as individuals and values of our community, and they involve serious matters, not just like district court does, but even more serious matters involving children. And since we hadn't had that filled, and we understanding the limit, the various different fiscal issues, we have waited to a place and point where we can't wait anymore to ask.
What about physical space? Because I know covering something recently, it was a circuit court judge, but his office was over at the district court building.
We have more problems in terms of space with our circuit courts, in terms of adding circuit court judges. Just basically, we don't have enough jury trial courtrooms. In terms of district court, we're able to accommodate an additional judge. In terms of family court, we have an additional courtroom also in Kapolei. That, you see, when we're talking about Kapolei and family court, you need to understand that in 2007 or 2008, the legislature gave us two positions for a family court, for two family court judge positions, but they weren't able to fund it because of the Great Recession. In 2013 and 14, they funded one of them. The point being that when we built the Kapolei courtroom, we built it for the additional two judges, so we have that court. And we have an extra courtroom also in district court that we would be able to use.
Right, so you just want some warm bodies in there.
Yeah, we just, you know what, we want to do is be able to handle these cases in a way that serves the public interest in terms of all the various different constitutional rights, to be able to provide for decisions that are made in an expeditious way that takes into account the rights of everyone concerned. And we don't want to be in a position where we have to continue cases because of court congestion, because there's so many cases, which is what's happening now. We know that the DUIs involve a serious issue with respect to our community, and they involve problems that individuals have that are criminal in nature, but yet also affect their family lives, their personal lives. And the fact is that, you know, not to be able to hear these cases in a timely way is something that frustrates us, and it frustrates the community. And in the long run, you know, what happens is that if we're not able to process and hear these cases, as we know, people can get hurt and have gotten hurt. And that's something that we take very seriously. But we need to have the resources to be able to address it. And being able to be understanding that resources are limited, we wouldn't ask unless it was absolutely looking at the balance of what we should prioritize in terms of community safety as well as accountability as well as due process. We wouldn't make this ask unless it was absolutely necessary.
We were talking to Judge Robert Mark Browning about the requests by the judiciary for additional judges on Maui, Kauai, and Oahu. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation on HPR1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chamber Music Hawaii, presenting the Galliard String Quartet with violist Anna Womack, performing Brahms String Quintet No. 2 this Monday at Doris Duke Theater. ChamberMusicHawaii.org.
It's now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Investigations editor John Hill has a deep dive on a home invasion story from almost two decades ago. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So share with our listeners where this all began.
It started in 2000. There was a home invasion robbery in Pearl City. There were five perpetrators who came into a man's house, and a gun went off and he was wounded, and they were all convicted of various crimes and did various sentences, and that seemed to be the end of that, except it wasn't.
And these involved teenagers?
Yes. Three of them were adults and two were minors, which turned out to be an important aspect of the case.
So share with us what this story is all about, because, my gosh, 19 years later, and it's a real eye-opener.
Yeah, well, what happened initially is, of course, they were all convicted or pled to various crimes. But then the man who was wounded, Robert Wong, went to court, and in Hawaii, you can go after the parents of a minor child. In fact, in any state, you can do that who's committed a crime. What's different about Hawaii is that there's no cap on the damages that can be claimed. So this case has made its way through the courts for almost 20 years. And the victim in this case, Mr. Wong, is on the verge of taking the house of the mother of one of the perpetrators.
Yes, and I, as I was reading your story this morning, there was a line in there, both parties are so bitter, and it's just so sad what's happened in this case.
It is, and whether you see it as fair and just depends on your point of view. To Mr. Wong, the victim, it's a long-delayed compensation for what he went through. He's had a lot of physical pain. He's had permanent injuries from this attack. On the other hand, the woman who is on the verge of losing her house, Deborah Villa, is the mother of one of the defendants in this case who wasn't the one who shot the gun. He was a minor, and because she's the only one who apparently has assets, she is the one that he has targeted, his lawyers have targeted to recover damages.
Right, and so the other parties basically have not paid the victim anything, right?
That's right. Three of them were adults when they committed the crime, so they were on the hook personally. Their parents were not involved. The law only applies to parents of minor children, and that one of them is still in prison. So, of course, he doesn't have any assets. He was the one who fired the rifle, and the other ones don't have much in the way of assets. So then that leaves, just her, really.
Right. And so we all know how hard it is to make a living here in Hawaii and to actually buy a home. And Ms. Villa really is in danger of losing her home and being homeless.
Yeah. And part of the story with her is that she, a couple of years after this crime, she got into a program, a low-income housing program that allowed her to basically build her own house or get together with a group of other people. And they built each other's houses over the course of a year. It was the only way that she could afford to live in Hawaii. And, in fact, the house is her only asset. So she says that she may be on the streets if this goes through, which it looks like it will.
And again, you said, yeah, is justice being served here?
Yeah, and I think it really does depend on your point of view. We've had a lot of comments on this story today, and a lot of people are sort of on the side of the victim and saying, well, this is what happens when your child is out of control and does these things. On the other hand, I think there are some who would say that, she was not there at the time. Her son was 16. He was not the shooter. And is it fair that she loses her house? It's a tough question, and Hawaii is almost unique in allowing this. Other states have laws that hold parents responsible for the actions of their children, but they put a cap on how much can be recovered from the parents, and it's usually not that high. It's maybe $10,000, $20,000. Hawaii and Louisiana are the only states that have no caps.
Yeah, sad story all around. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
That was Investigations editor John Hill with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Aloha, Noe Tanigawa here from Aloha Shorts on the Road. Mahalo, hilo, and pukalani. Good times. And Lihue, you're up next. Saturday, February 16th, HPR presents the best of Aloha Shorts live, right in your backyard. Local literature for and about our island home. First performed on the radio program, Aloha Shorts. Just a few seats left at hprtickets.org.
Sponsored in part by Kamuela Farmers Market.
Stop if you love me. That's the theme of a campaign underway this week to discourage people from texting or using their cell phones when they should be focused on safe driving. Here on Oahu this morning, students at Washington Middle School waved signs to drive home the message. Throughout this week, students across the state heard a compelling story about the damage done to one family. J.C. Good survived a crash years ago caused by a distracted driver. We talked to her while she was on Kauai talking to students there.
I lost my parents and almost my own life at the hands of a driver who was talking on his cell phone. And so it's been sharing the message that there is nothing on a phone more important than a human life, and that we've got the science to back it up. We know how dangerous all cell phone use is when we're the only person in control of a car, and still we just think that every one of us have to be the exception to that rule. And you start to look at the research and how dangerous, we're talking about texting, obviously, but we have to look a little farther than that, because now the surveys are showing that people are FaceTiming and watching YouTube, watching Netflix, or trying to manipulate Google Maps or playlists, or even just having a conversation. Talking on the phone makes a driver four times more likely to crash, which is the same as driving with a 0.08 blood alcohol content. You're a drunk driver when you're doing this thing that doesn't necessarily feel distracting, but that's killing thousands of people on our roads every year.
So this has really become, kind of a crusade for you then because of what happened to you. Share with our listeners what happened that day.
It was my college graduation day, and the morning, it was so perfect. Kind of my life was in the palm of my hands. It was everything I had always dreamt my life would be. It was kind of coming to fruition, and I had worked so hard. And then my parents and I just had this easy drive to get home. It was an hour and a half drive that we'd done lots of times that ended horribly that afternoon when driver talking on his cell phone turned left through a red light, and when he did that, he was on an intersecting road, he pulled out in front of a semi-truck, swerved, and as a result hit my family's car. Neither of my parents survived even a moment. They were both killed immediately. I was given a 10% chance of living through the night and survived, but still live with a partial paralysis as a result, even now. It's 11 years ago this happened.
And what's your mobility today?
I am mobile. My left ankle and toes, kind of lower half of my left leg are paralyzed, and same with my arm, that there's almost no motion in my elbow, absolutely nothing in my wrist or my fingers. So I mostly get by. I have to wear a brace. I still trip and fall more often than the average person. It just kind of takes extra caution everywhere I go.
Okay, but you're not confined to a wheelchair. You do have some mobility back.
No.
Yeah, but it's still hard.
Yeah.
So when you go to these schools, what do you see after you've talked to these kids about what happened to you and what they can do?
Honestly, the biggest, the thing I hear more often than almost anything else is that young people seem to get this, that this message has been out there for a long time, and they kind of understand that there's this one place where it's not okay to use a phone. But unfortunately, they all want to know how they can get their parents to stop, these people who are setting the example for the young people of our world, who just, again, it's that feeling of invincibility because it doesn't necessarily feel dangerous. Don't get a ticket. You don't crash your car, and then you think that you must be the exception. And unfortunately, again, there is no such thing when you know how dangerous this is and how many people it's killing, how selfish it is for anyone to be using their phone.
Talk about the statistics.
Statistics are so tough on this issue because we don't know how many people are being killed or hurt. You know, there's no breathalyzer for a cell phone, you know, when a police officer pulls someone over or a crash happens. So looking at the numbers, there's a lot of different numbers out there. You look at what's happening in our country, it's 40,000 deaths on our roads every year, 27%. That's 10,000 people killed every year because of that choice that a phone was more important than a human life. You have to be able to speak up when you're looking at the fact that it's your life on the line, and you wouldn't get in the car with your parents if mom or dad had been drinking. It was young people who changed that issue. Young people changed seatbelts. Young people changed recycling by demanding that we change the world that we live in. And I think this issue, young people have the power to really make a big difference, especially when they're in the passenger seat. You know, you can designate yourself as the texter. I'm the designated texter. Let me answer the phone, whatever you need to say to keep each other alive. I know that I was given kind of this big, horrible story that I wish I didn't have. I wish I could undo it, but as long as that's not really an option, maybe these young people can take this big, horrible story and they can help me to share it and tell their mom or their dad that they love them. They want them to be there for those next monuments. And, you know, they want mom to be there for graduation day. They want their dad to be there to walk them down the aisle, to be the grandparents of the kids that they'll have someday. Those are things that I don't have, and I get to share that with young people to help them to have the courage to speak up.
So I don't know how much time you've had to spend here in Hawaii on this trip, but have you noticed more drivers on the phone or distracted, you know, compared to other places across the country that you've gone to?
Honestly, and we've only been here for the weekend, so it's been short. I'm coming from, last stop was in Florida, which has some of the worst laws in the country, and compared to Florida, Hawaii is looking very good. You know, every state has its own issues, but you do see that when states have stronger laws, as Hawaii does, it makes a difference in observable behavior.
Well, I know that there are many people, many lawmakers, that are looking long and hard at how to keep our roads and sidewalks safer, because we had a terrible crash a couple weeks ago where three people were killed.
Yeah.
They're looking at ways they can toughen the DUI laws, you know, all kinds of things.
Absolutely. You start to look at all of those deaths on our roads and the high percentage. I think it's over 90% of crashes are happening because of human error. Again, it's those choices. It's the choice to drink and drive. It's the choice to answer the phone. It's a choice to go faster than the law, the science. says we should go and kills too many people.
That was J.C. Good, survivor of a crash caused by a distracted driver. She was brought out to Hawaii thanks to a program with the Department of Education, Dietrich Insurance, and PAR Hawaii.
Aloha, I'm E.J. Dionne. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the show, we mentioned that today marks the 8th anniversary of The Conversation here on HPR. The show's been through several changes, but with all of the surgery the show has undergone, there is one goal we've kept in mind, to bring you fresh local news from the people in your communities. We've always aired NPR at the top of the hour, and in the early years of the show, we'd aired newscasts from international bureaus rotating through a set lineup. Every day of the week, we shared a worldwide perspective in global headlines with a different contributor, all of which included Yonhap, a South Korean news agency based in Seoul, NDTV, a newscast originating in New Delhi, India, also our primary source for the latest cricket scores, and our European sources comprised of Deutsche Welle, or DW, Germany's public international broadcaster, and the BBC, the British broadcasting company headquartered in Westminster, London. And lastly, Al Jazeera, a state-funded broadcaster in Qatar. And that's all of them. We didn't get anyone who got it right, but Brad and Kona got 3 out of 5. So congratulations to you. If you have an idea for a quiz, you can always send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Leila Kealoha lives near where several fissures opened up after the Kilauea volcano erupted in 2018. Steam still comes up through the vents along her driveway. And while the earthquakes that came right before the eruption and the lingering smells in the air make her anxious, it's the loss of her beloved ohia trees that really strikes at her core. H2O radio reporter Franny Halpern has the story.
When Hawaii's Kilauea volcano erupted in 2018, dramatic photos at the time showed homes and roads being engulfed by lava flowing to the sea. But unless you looked closely at those images, you might have missed signs of another disaster already underway. In many places on the island, a huge number of trees were dying or already dead.
Ohia has always been my favorite tree. It's the most abundant native tree that's found in Hawaii. So about six years ago, we started noticing the trees were dying really quickly, like just all brown.
That's Leila Kealoha, and I'm with her at her house in the Puna district on the eastern part of the Big Island, about a half mile from where several fissures opened up during the eruption. While the event with its earthquakes and foul-smelling air left her anxious, it's the loss of the ohia tree that really strikes at her core.
We've had this long-term relationship with ohia. And we built our house to face the forest. Right off our back bedroom, there's a porch, you know, to see our beautiful ohia forest. And now it's pretty much dead. It's devastating.
Ohia trees are the backbone of Hawaiian forests, as they provide food and habitat for countless species found nowhere else on Earth. The trees are revered in Hawaiian culture and take their name from a legend that champions the love of a young couple, Ohia and Lahua, whom the volcano goddess Pele tried to separate. When the tree started dying, Leila contacted the state forester and other residents did too. The state began working with federal agencies and ultimately discovered that 2 related types of fungus were attacking the trees. The more aggressive one could kill off an affected ohia within a matter of days or weeks, causing the disease to be coined rapid ohia death. But identifying the fungus was only the first step. Stopping it from killing every single tree in the state, that was going to be the next challenge. I'm standing at a trailhead about 30 miles northwest of Layla's house. Here I've met Bill Stormon with the State Division of Forestry and Wildlife to learn more about how the fungus spreads and what's being done to stop it. Before we enter this healthy ohia forest, we clean our shoes to make sure we're not tracking in any spores from an affected tree. After brushing the soles, we then spray them with 70% rubbing alcohol. Bill says you really can't be too careful.
The vascular tissue just gets filled up with this gunk, this fungal gunk, if you will. But it clogs up the plumbing in the tree, and the tree goes very quickly because it's not getting any more moisture.
And then I thought I read something about a beetle being involved.
Yes. When a tree is infected, it begins to put off ethanol and other chemical markers that tell everybody around it in the bug world, I'm dying. And they begin to attack these trees. In their boring behavior, they put out boring dust, very fine boring dust, and frass, which is their excrement, basically. And it's got the fungal pathogen in that boring dust and the frass. The wind picks that up, gets into wounds in other trees, and that's, as best as we can tell, that's probably the primary vector for its spread.
To date, more than 135,000 acres on Hawaii Island have been affected by rapid ohia death. And recently, the fungus was found on Kauai, somehow leapfrogging over Maui and Oahu. Given that it's pretty unlikely that a beetle or even the wind carried it that far, Bill says one thing he knows that could have made that journey, people's boots. Stopping rapid ohia death is critical for watersheds on the islands because ohia are the first to get established on new lava flows. A young tree's roots break up the rock and create soil that in turn creates habitat for other plants to grow and eventually build a forest which can absorb rains and add to the aquifer. If you lose the forest, you lose the water. Whether you're a resident of the islands or one of the millions who visit, you're there for the natural beauty. That's the message of a major outreach effort underway, especially with tour operators explaining that everyone has a role to play in stopping the fungus. Currently, there's a competition sponsored by the Department of the Interior, National Park Service, and other partners offering a $70,000 prize to anyone who can come up with an innovative way to detect the disease quickly because current methods are slow and expensive. Having an effective solution emerge from the competition would give Layla hope. She's worried that her newborn son will never see an ohia tree, and that would deprive him not only of the watershed's benefits, but also of his cultural heritage.
You know, speaking from a Hawaiian cultural perspective, it is one of the most important trees to our hula halau, for those that dance hula or that honor the goddess Laka, which is the goddess of hula.
Hula, she says, is how stories have been told over generations. Stories of how people lived on the islands and their gods and goddesses, because up until the missionaries came, there was no written language to pass those along. Going into the forest to collect ohia buds, leaves, and flowers was integral to making leis and other hula adornments and for preserving a culture's history.
If you're not able to go and gather, then you're losing that relationship, right? So you're not actually going to the forest to get these things because you don't want to be the reason why it's being spread.
Right.
So you're just gonna disconnect, and there's going to be this deeper disconnect, you know, spiritually, emotionally, all those types of things as well. So healthy forest, healthy people, right? Unhealthy forest, unhealthy people. That relationship is becoming really challenging.
To learn more about rapid ohia death and the ohia challenge, go to our website at h2oradio.org. From Pahoa, Hawaii, I'm Franny Halperin.
That wraps it up for today. Up tomorrow, lots of hand-wringing over the state budget. Tell us what's on your mind. Call or talk back line and leave us a comment. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, and Twitter at HI Conversation, and we're on iTunes, too. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.